Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Peter Salmon. What's up, y'all?
So, you're always so happy to be here.
Of course I am. This is End Credits, sir. Always happy to be here.
We already introduced it as End Credits. So...
Right. In case they just tuned in later, right?
In case they missed the intro by 10 seconds. Okay, fair enough. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new romantic drama, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I was going to say Lady on Fire, but it's Portrait of a Lady on Fire. But yeah, that's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to look at some of the movie news from the past week, including Indiana Jones. What year is this? But apparently it's the year that Steven Spielberg doesn't want to make Indiana Jones movies anymore. Then, Lizzie McGuire news. It's apparently too hot for Disney Plus. So what happens when a creator wants to tell a more grown-up story of their formerly family-friendly character? Wow, that was a lot of Fs. Didn't realize that when I wrote that. But finally, bad guys aren't allowed to use iPhones in movies, at least according to Rian Johnson. Has he ruined storytelling forever? But first, big business news for the biggest studio this week. The Disney CEO, Bob Iger, announced that effective immediately he was stepping down as the CEO of the Walt Disney Company. Bob Iger is, you know, not someone people listening to the show are probably intimately familiar with or even vaguely familiar with. But, I mean, if you've liked the outcome of Disney for the last 15 years, he is the man to whom credit goes, because he has been the CEO of Disney for 15 years, and in that time, he has overseen $100 billion worth of acquisitions.
That's a good amount. That's good on you, sir. Good on you. And I'm not going to lie, until, I've heard about him when we started on credits, but, like, you know, when I was younger, I hadn't heard about him at all either. Disney, they're private, right? And I kind of respect that, but yeah, I don't know. Him retiring is also revealing all this information, which shows, you know, he was a good man, at least good for Disney.
Well, good for Disney's bottom
line,
good
for Disney,
sure.
Disney period, yeah.
So under Iger's watch, Disney acquired Pixar. A lot of people think Pixar's been, like, a part of Disney for years, but it was
the Apple,
and,
right?
Yeah, Steve Dick, not Steve Dick. Dude, that's a very that was a very Guelph Freudian slip.
Kathy Griffin's ex?
Yeah, Steve Jobs.
Yeah. Oh no, the other one.
Steve Jobs bought it. Well, he bought Pixar from Lucasfilm.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. And Pixar's been floating around.
And then he turned Pixar into its own thing. And then Disney bought it outright in 2006. Then he bought Marvel in 2010, and then he bought Lucasfilm in 2012, and then the coup de grace, the biggest piece of them all, was buying the majority of 21st Century Fox last year.
When he started, was Disney already number one? Do you know, or was Viacom ahead, or
in terms of
like
size?
That? Yeah,
I think that probably was Warner Brothers.
Okay, so yeah, no, good on him. Good
Warner.
On him.
I mean, Disney was. Disney was already pretty big,
but in their own way.
I mean, it was if Disney wasn't top two, it was definitely top three. Mm-hmm. Because you know, it bought ABC in 90 something, so that upped them. That, you know, that took them up a notch too. But you know, buying 20th Century Fox, which I don't think was top three. Like, the top three studios were basically Disney, Warner Brothers, Universal, and they all kind of, like, traded up and down depending on the year. Then in the back, you have Sony, which is Columbia and TriStar. You have 20th Century Fox, and you have Viacom, CBS, which is mostly just Paramount Pictures. So, you know, buying Fox upped its stakes so much that it's now like head and shoulders. Like they have 40% of the market now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So
well, they have all of 20th Century Fox, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, now it's 20th Century Pictures.
Oh, right. Sorry. My apologies, Mr. Disney.
And it's Searchlight Pictures. Then it's not Fox Searchlight anymore. It's Searchlight Pictures. Mm-hmm. They did that very. That almost seems like the.
He's taking away more freedom. I'm giving him compliments, but like I love all those other studios too. But
well, this is it. It's like if you want to talk about Bob Iger's legacy, it's a tremendous business legacy. Mm. Like in terms of like building an empire, he is second to none.
Yep.
In terms of like buying up like the real estate that has made it infinitesimally harder for like the Universals and the Warner Brothers and especially the Sonys and the Paramounts to play ball on their level, that, you know, he's pretty much secured Disney. I mean, unless everyone decides to start hating Marvel movies and Star Wars and Pixar movies, Disney is going to be dominant forever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't even know if there's any competition anymore. I don't think even if, you know, like what you said, Warner Bros. Or whatever bought out a bunch of other companies, I don't, mm-hmm. they would probably not be at that level yet either.
No, and the last big one...
Because even just separated from Disney, Marvel was already huge, right?
Yeah, they bought Marvel the year after...
The Lucasfilms, of course. That's, well, yeah, the biggest one.
They bought Marvel the year after Iron Man came out.
The year after, okay.
So Marvel was already, like, setting itself up as a Hollywood player, and then Disney comes in and sort of gives it that security. Yeah. I'm not sure, like, I think Marvel probably would have been a success without Disney, but Disney probably gave Marvel a certain degree of security.
I think you just said, though, it was Marvel's attempt, but I think Disney did a better job making it an open world, you know, with, like, so many intertwined separate films.
Yeah,
and Marvel might have been more standalones, or at least like DC's films connected, but like not to a ridiculously noticeable degree.
Well, that's what I mean by them giving, you know, giving Marvel more security, because that's the direction Marvel wanted to go in. But it's harder to sort of think that far ahead when you're kind of self-investing.
Yep.
Although, you know, they self-invested in Iron Man. They borrowed $100 million. That paid off huge. That wasn't always going to be the case. Or they couldn't always guarantee that that would be the case. And then, you know, indeed, the movie right after Iron Man, which a lot of people forget, The Incredible Hulk, did not do as well.
Yeah, I liked it. But yeah, and like you said, it was Disney that bought it after. So I can kind of see then the time and why Edward Norton was fired around then.
Well, that's the other thing,
He's
too.
He's not a family guy.
If Marvel doesn't have Disney's backing, does Marvel lose Kevin Feige? Because a lot of the things, you know, we're talking about, the expansion of the Marvel Universe to include Black Panther, to include Captain Marvel, to include Black Widow standalone movie coming out, things like The Eternals, which is coming out, the Shang-Chi movie, all that is because of Ike Perlmutter, who technically owns Marvel, has been sort of sidelined because Disney backs Kevin Feige on the movies because of Feige's track record.
Which ones is she? Directed?
Kevin Feige's the head of Marvel Studios.
Oh, okay, okay.
So and he's the producer on every Marvel movie.
Oh, okay, that's why I see his name all the time.
Yeah, but Ike Perlmutter's the guy who owns like the Marvel, like the whole Marvel. Like he owns the like he runs the Marvel Entertainment, which includes the comic books and the animated series and the toys. Mm-hmm. But he's famously cheap. He's famously, I don't want to say racist and misogynist, but he leans that way. He doesn't, he's the guy
who fight against it.
He's the guy who says, like, who's going to buy Black Widow toys, even though there's clearly an appetite.
And probably very okay with the cuts when they air them in China and such.
Yeah, he's pure business guy. Yeah, you're right.
And that's why, like, you know, maybe it's good Bob Iger's stepping down. I don't know what this next guy is going to be like, but maybe
Bob Chapek is taking over, and a lot of people think it's a weird choice. And I was, you know, I don't read the business section a lot.
He's been a secondhand man for a while, right?
He's been the head of Disney Parks and Resorts, which is the biggest piece of the Disney empire. Mm-hmm. It makes 26 $6 billion a year, as opposed to like the Disney
films, like $3 billion-ish. Two.
Actually, the box office for last year was $11 billion.
Oh, geez.
But I mean, that's because they had Avengers,
all the Star Wars and all that. Yeah, yeah.
They had Avengers, Star Wars, Frozen, Pixar. They had Toy Story 4, and then like Maleficent, Dumbo. Like that was an insanely good
but still
year.
Nowhere close to the Disneylands and parks. So.
Right, but it's still, yeah, $26 million, and Chapek also oversaw the expansion of Disney parks, like the addition of Galaxy's Edge.
And that Dwayne The Rock one there's going to be a film about?
Hmm?
That Dwayne
The Rock. Oh, the Jungle Cruise?
Yeah, yeah, the Jungle Cruise. That'd be sweet.
And then, yeah, he opened Disneyland in Shanghai. But a lot of people thought it was going to be this fellow, if I can find his name, Kevin Meyer, who is the head of the direct-to-consumer division, which includes Disney Plus. And when you consider how much money they've put into Disney Plus, I mean, it's nothing like parks, but
it's also Disney Plus is doing okay, but yeah. It's nothing special, and it has more loading issues than Netflix and such. Whereas, like you said,
well, at least, I don't have Disney Plus, so
least,
I don't know.
At least for me, yeah, like hardcore. That could be Sony Android TVs, but I don't know. I'm blaming Disney Plus.
But your other apps don't have the trouble.
Yeah, no, they never have that issue. Yeah, so right. Even if it's just the Sony one, thanks Disney. So yeah, I don't know if that's like as huge a success as the Disney parks. Although I guess Bob Chaper had it easier with the parks because they've been around since the 20s or whatever.
50s.
It's
not quite
50s and successful.
No, so. It's definitely.
But amusement parks are also way less popular, so I think he must be very strong and working very hard to have, you know, maintained its power. So,
yeah, it's. I mean, it shows you.
I trust him. I think this is better than the Disney Plus guy. And you said the toys too, right?
Yeah,
they're okay, but I don't know. They're not as popular as they were, say, a few years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know. When I go to Walmart and stuff or whatever, there's not nearly as many. I don't see as many kids running around them.
Mm. We'll get into the issues with Disney Plus shortly, but it does make you sort of realize where the priority is for Disney. Because even as Bob Iger stepping down, he's like, I want to get more involved in creative things. And it's like, are you a creative guy? I'm not sure that you are. But they're prioritizing the business. They looked at the guys running like sort of each section of the business and like, okay, who's kind of making the most money? And it seems like that's why Bob Chapek is the heir apparent, is because
he's getting it done, right?
He's getting it done. That's basically it. And we'll see what happens, because I don't know what happens to, you know, next to Disney. Like,
yeah. Like what?
Like what can they buy now? Because because Iger's stepping down, technically has like a year and a half left on his contract, but I'm wondering if it's like the line from Die Hard that Hans Gruber says, like, Alexander wept because he had no more worlds to conquer. I wonder if Bob Iger sort of looked at his spreadsheet and he wept because there are no more worlds to conquer. But we'll see what happens. Speaking of worlds to conquer, Spielberg won't be conquering Indiana Jones anymore. He has announced, I'm not sure if it was an official announcement from Spielberg, but Variety broke the story that Steven Spielberg is stepping down from Indiana Jones 5 and that James Mangold is likely the man who will be directing it next.
I would, the headline may be very sad after the Spielberg thing, but then brighten me up very much so for James Mangold. So yeah. I love Logan in his other works.
Ford v Ferrari.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
310 to Yuma. I mean, he's a very good
jeepers.
Sort of big audience kind of director, and he's able to do interesting things.
And currently successful, right? So, and Ford Ferrari was just a car biopic. If he was able to get it at 155 or something, he'll be able to get this Indiana Jones a heck of a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Well,
as long as he brings back Shia LaBeouf.
Really?
That's Indiana Jones, isn't it? Oh, did Harrison Ford not throw him that hat?
No,
Harrison Ford threw that
hat. No, the hat blows off the hook and he goes to put it on.
Oh, okay, my apologies.
And Harrison Ford takes it right back.
Okay. I got to rewatch.
Yeah,
do you?
No, you're right. Have to rewatch Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Actually, I'm not a hater. I thought it was a perfectly fine Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah, I did too. I didn't mind the alien thing. I found Temple of Doom had some pretty wild stuff too.
Temple of Doom is crazy because it's like in this like really dark period where both Lucas and Spielberg are both like going through divorces. Like there's clearly other stuff going on for Spielberg because this was like in the wake of the Twilight Zone movie debacle. This is like right after E.T. is like the most successful movie of all time. And it's like all cheerful and bright and life affirming. And you got to figure, like, you're just like, this is just all BS. Yeah. Like, I want to be dark and depressing. And I want Indiana Jones to like go in there and look like he's going to kill some kids.
I just want to find the final clip though. Cause I totally forgot Harrison Ford takes the hat back. And that is gold. That is genius. It really is. Has Harrison Ford been confirmed for this?
Yeah, it's. I mean, this is the thing, right? It's the triad has always been you have to get Lucas on board, Spielberg on board, and Ford on board. Lucas sold his stake, so he's out.
Yeah.
Now Spielberg's out, and I'm wondering, like, Harrison Ford's like 80. I want to say,
yeah, nearing something. That.
Does he really want to be running around?
Maybe. I feel like if they did it, there'd be a new Indiana Jones, and he would just be kind of helping him out, like watching kind of the old Nighthawk sort of thing.
Right. It just, you know, Drew McWeeny in his newsletter on the weekend, I think this is the second weekend in a row I've mentioned Drew McWeeny, but that's fine. Like he just asked the question, like, if Spielberg isn't down, what is this for? Because it seems like the whole point of making another Indiana Jones was to make up for quote-unquote mistakes.
And bring forth some, you know, nostalgia that people enjoy. And without Spielberg's name on there.
Because this was always kind of Spielberg's thing. I mean, it was always like he wanted to make a James Bond movie, but of course the Chubby Broccoli was like, well, you're not British, so you can't make a James Bond movie, Steven Spielberg.
That was fair.
And so, well, it maybe. But it's... So George Lucas came to him and was like, well, why don't you try Indiana Jones instead? This thing I made up. And then that became the thing, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it just seems so bizarre. It, you know, even though you could, you know, Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, which, you know, was a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I mean, also had a lot of great directors involved in it. Frank Darabont directed several episodes. You know, a slightly different thing. But by and large, when it comes to the movies, this has always been Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's not interested, should any of us be interested?
Yeah, well, you said it'll be one of the three things that are a huge part of Indiana Jones, right?
Yeah.
That's a fail, right? That's a fail.
It just seems to me like I hesitate to mention this, but if they want to make more Indiana Jones, and I have complete faith in James Mangold that he can make a great Indiana Jones movie, but, you know, why not just say, here's Indiana Jones, like, do what you want with it. If you want to set it in the 30s and cast somebody new as Indiana Jones, like, go for it. You know, it's going to happen at some point. Someone mm-hmm. is going to want to try and remake it. So, like, if you've got a director like Mangold on board, like, just let him go to town. Like, let him hire Bradley Cooper or something and, you know, like, try it again. It might work. It might not work. Maybe get Harrison Ford's seal of approval. Maybe do, like, the Young Indiana Jones thing where you have old Harrison Ford and, like, bookended prologues or something. You know? But if we're going to, if we're still going full hog, like, we're going to have octogenarian Indiana Jones in 1971 fighting, I don't know, the VC.
Yeah.
You know? Like, the Viet Cong have... what, like the Shroud of Turin or something?
And yeah, that'd be,
he's
that'd be,
you know, leaping around the jungle, fighting Charlie. I'm not sure.
There's a lot of cool archaeological stuff in those areas, though. But
well, true.
So
but
they would be able to make it easily part of the plot. But yeah, it'd be very weird.
Do you really want to, like, Indiana Jones, this is Nixon.
Yeah.
You gotta get that thing before Charlie gets it.
No.
I'm not sure.
I don't want that.
Nobody wants that. Okay.
And also, you mentioned Bradley Cooper. What does Bradley Cooper have to do with this?
I've heard Bradley Cooper mentioned before as a potential Indiana Jones replacement.
That'd be kind of cool.
Just like, you know, a handsome mofo who's like charismatic. I think, you know, he could probably do the
job. And he's proper age too. Yeah, he's like 40s, I think.
Yeah, he could do it.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to take a quick break and play a bit of Matt Monroe. Before your time, so I'm not sure what you're oohing about. Anyway, we'll be right back. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU.
And he would need the glow of dawn that paints the sky above to try and paint a portrait of my love.
So that was Matt Monroe. Is he your speed?
Oh, he's my speed, of course. A little too fast, but I can live.
Well, I also know that Lizzie McGuire is also Peter's speed.
You see, you're joking there. I do. I loved Lizzie McGuire growing up.
No, you said in the email that you were doing
okay,
a rewatch.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you were joking. Yeah, no, I love Lizzie McGuire. I'm watching it right now. It's phenomenal. And I was so excited for this because it was all of the good things from the first two seasons, but not her, you know, her friend. Well, I forget her character's name because I don't like her, but her main female friend is just such a bad influence on them. And just, I just, and her whole sinning and left it thing, it was just, she really destroyed the plot of it. So I was hoping, right. And it doesn't seem like she's going to be in it.
Let's set the table because what we're talking about is Lizzie McGuire, which was a show in the early aughts starring Hilary Duff as a young girl experiencing, you know, life and friends and hanging out and issues and things.
Birth by Carradine.
Right. It was I want to say it was a Disney Channel show.
Yeah, it was Disney Family Channel.
Yeah. They were bringing it back for Disney Plus. They brought back the original creator, Terry Minsky. They brought back Hilary Duff. They brought back everybody who was in the cast.
Mm-hmm. Well, other than who I was talking about.
Other than the girl Peter hates for ruining the show. And they're all set to go. They completed two episodes. Terry Minsky left the show because of creative differences.
Left. Using finger quotes there.
Finger quotes. There was a inamicable separation, let's say.
Yeah.
And now Hilary Duff has gone online to basically infer that the show was, quote unquote, speaking of finger quotes, too adult for Disney Plus, and that maybe it will be sent to Hulu, where things that are too hot for Disney Plus will end up.
But see, I don't know if that would be possible because it was on the Family Channel and one of the like fully owned Disney works, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I don't know. I guess Disney would have to sell.
Disney owns a majority stake in Hulu from when they bought Fox.
Oh, okay. So it would still be Disney attached.
It would just be shunting because they've done it. They've actually already done it twice because there's the High Fidelity show starring Zoe Kravitz. That I think is on Stars here in Canada, but it was supposed to be on, Disney Plus, but they moved it to Hulu in the States, and then they did the same thing for Love, Victor, which is a series based on the same book as Love, Simon.
Yep, yep. And that was its name on Disney, right? They wanted to call it that, and then had to change the name. Yeah,
right. And so that's going to Hulu as well, and which makes people wonder because why is Disney greenlighting these things?
I still think Disney will probably get this one done. And I think if not, like you said, it's a guarantee they'll sell it to Hulu or somewhere else partially owned by Disney. Because we're talking about it right now, like just this little one Instagram hint towards it not happening, you know, Hilary Duff, our small article you sent me. And it's huge, right? And I remember when the main guy got his role back, you know. People loved it. That was all over the news. And this was one of the even more hyped than the Proud Family and a lot of the other way more hyped than the Mighty Ducks and all the other ones we've heard about.
Yeah.
So I think it'd be really silly if Disney didn't. And if they didn't, it would just be because Hilary Duff didn't sign another contract or whatever.
Well, it's weird because who's the series like going to be for, right? Is it going to be for like new people who maybe heard an older sibling or heard a parent talk about Lizzie McGuire? Was it going to be for like Lizzie McGuire fans, people who grew up with her?
I think it'll be for millennials who are Lizzie McGuire fans and who have kids.
Yeah.
It's like the four, that's what they'll, hey, it's a, for kids, but I love it, so, you know.
Because, and the other part of this, too, is like, what does adult mean? Like, is,
yeah, is it's there, harder to tell.
Is there going to be, like, scenes where, like, her and her friends are, like, in a hookah bar, like, smoking up? Or, you know, is there going to be hardcore nudity or things?
It would be, I think it would be more like what the plots were for her parents in the first two. Except more in depth into that, so that, you know, the issues that they probably dealt with in their bedroom that we didn't get to see. But that and kids. It'll be her, you know, and the kids. I think what I thought is her kids will be possibly more of the main character.
Mm.
Not to like a ridiculous degree, but I think they'll be quite centered.
Yeah, it just, it seems so silly. And the thing is, too, Disney Plus is still like greenlighting. Like, they've greenlit a TV series based on True Lies.
They're just letting people hear about these greenlits way too early.
Right. They're just, and there's like a Turner and Hooch movie. And it's like,
that'll be interesting.
I remember seeing Turner and Hooch in the theater, but I was probably like 3 or 4 years too young for it. So it was hardly like a family friendly property either. It just seems like, you know, and this seems to be a thing that's happening all over Disney. Like, they have these, like, very big, bold ideas. Like, we're going to do a Han Solo movie directed by Lord and Miller. And then they're like, oh, no, they're going too far off into creative territory, and we can't have that.
But The Simpsons is on Disney Plus, too,
that
right?
That, too.
And they, you know, they haven't censored it or anything. I just,
no, they
weird.
Just, they just, well, screwed up the aspect
did.
Ratio.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I'm past the part where it looks weird. And it didn't, it never looked ridiculously noticeably weird.
Well, it did to enough of Simpsons Twitter.
But. No, I know. Yeah, so I don't know. Disney's just being silly. Simpsons is probably one of their most viewed ones, and I really wish they would let Liz McGuire and the director that they let go, Minsky, have more freedom. I'd really like that. And I think, again, it would attract more millennials like me, especially the ones who have kids and, you know, want to watch something they can both like. But again, also, I'd be okay if it was Hulu, because there would be more freedom probably. Well, and Hulu, we get on our we don't get Hulu, right? But Hulu originals, I think, air on our Bravo channel or one of our other.
It would
channels.
End up at some channel. Or
yeah,
other.
Yeah, because Handmaid's Tale. So that'd be pretty sweet.
Yeah,
we sometimes got like with Twin Peaks, and so we get it a bit earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Conners too, which is pretty sweet. So I would love that.
It just the other part of this too is that you want to create a continuity, right? Because like, presumably you watch Disney Plus and see the old Lizzie McGuire's, and you'd be able to segue into the new Lizzie McGuire's.
Yep.
And now you're saying, like, no. Because that's another interesting part of this, too, is that, you know, there are shows that began on broadcast TV, which has very, very tight controls.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go to streaming services where things are a little bit more relaxed. And I was reading about the cases of, like, Veronica Mars, which was a broadcast show, and then they brought back. It was on Hulu in the States. It's on Crave here in Canada. And then Lucifer, which was started on Fox and is now on Netflix, and they're producing new seasons on Netflix.
Yeah.
And it's like they can go further with like swearing and, you know, violence and nudity.
But Netflix, right?
Well, the thing is that the producers and the creative people are like, we can go further, but we're also trying to create a sense of continuity, too, so that when you end at Lucifer Season 3, which is the last broadcast season, and you go into Lucifer Season 4, which is the first Netflix season, it's not all suddenly jarring.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's actually an episode in Lucifer Season 4 where, like, there's like, a part of it is an investigation at a nudist colony, and there's not, like, graphic nudity. It's all still very, like, censored nudity, like we're standing in front of potted plants and things. They could have done it because it's Netflix, but they don't because they're trying to create that sense of continuity. And it's just like, is Disney really under the impression that Lizzie McGuire or would like Terry Mazinski and everybody go so far off the map that there wouldn't be a sense of continuity from old Lizzie McGuire to new Lizzie McGuire? And it's boggling my mind because I have zero interest in Lizzie McGuire because it was way after my time.
Yeah, it was
but
great.
It does make me curious now, like, what does this series look like that Disney is like?
Yeah.
This is not, when we say family friendly at Disney, this is not what we mean.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, we'll find out. Or
hopefully.
Or not find out. Yeah.
We might not find out.
We might have a
out.
Lack of ever finding out.
I mean, gone are the days where you can like buy like bootleg pilots at comic conventions anymore too.
I miss them. You can't even. That's the sort of thing. Like you can torrent a lot, but you're not gonna be able to find that sort of thing to torrent either. Really.
No, I have a nice VHS of the Star Wars Holiday Special at home.
Yeah.
I don't. You can't get that on Disney Plus. That's for damn sure. So Rian Johnson, the director of Knives Out, did a nice little video that he broke down one of his scenes and talked about all his directing tricks. One of the things he pointed out, though, or maybe accidentally pointed out, was that Apple doesn't allow bad guys to use iPhones.
That's classic Apple, you know? And I use them, so I can't say anything, but yeah, well, they really are. They're so stern and just really care about their character and what they look like, you know? I don't know. I just don't get it because some people find like the villains the cool dudes in the film, right?
Yeah.
And I like, I don't know. There was certain, like, if I was watching a Hercules film and, like, you know, it was live action, not cartoon, like, and Hercules was using one, but then his was an Android and the evil dude's Hades was an iPhone, I'd use the iPhone because Hades was, it was funny and cool. So I'm just saying, I don't know if it's really going to help them get that many purchases. I guess if they're trying to attract more parents buying it for their kids or more like PC people or something. But I really, I don't know.
It seems so old fashioned. That's the thing. It's,
yeah. Well, because it's like studios nowadays don't have the kind of power to do that sort of thing. But, like IT companies like Apple, they can do that.
Well, this
sort
is
of
the
thing
is that a huge part of Apple's strategy is this kind of product placement.
Mm-hmm.
But they apparently do it for free. Like, Apple doesn't pay. Like, normally, if you want to have, like, your character eat a breakfast cereal, you go to Kellogg's and say, hey, for this amount of money, our main character will eat Frosted Flakes, and you'll see the Frosted Flakes box, and they'll be eating Frosted Flakes for, like, 5 minutes.
And Apple's like, as long as they don't break that rule sort of thing?
Apple's like, we don't want to pay you to have Apple products, but we will give you an iPhone and you can or give you iPhones and the characters can hold iPhones.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So there's that kind of blessing. This is all extraordinarily nebulous though, because Apple, like so many other businesses in Silicon Valley, don't, you know, really let people get a close look at their books to mm-hmm. see like exactly how much money is spent on this kind of thing. So it's a bit of, they're getting free advertising. They're letting creators have access to Apple stuff, but at the same time, they get to call the shots. Like, yeah, everything has a cost.
They have power over it.
Yeah. I wanted to do this. I mean, it's not like a big thing we can debate, but it's a good opener to talk about like other forms of corporate control. Because I just wanted to do a shout out to the art house cinemas in Canada, especially our own art house downtown. Because we're about to talk about Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and if you go to the bookshelf this week to see Portrait of a Lady on Fire or any bookshelf movie, you will see signs up that say that they will not be showing Little Women this week, as they were supposed to schedule to do, because Cineplex is still screening Little Women down at the Pergola Galaxy. So
it's a bigger screen. I might see it there. But I guess it is. It's an indie film. It's the kind that I do think an indie cinema should have,
right?
In order to, you know, help it survive.
And it's the second time it's happened in like the last couple of weeks, because the originally Knives Out was supposed to show at the bookshelf
a couple of weeks ago,
and it's still still showing at the Pergola Galaxy Cinema. So, bookshelf has been blocked, shall we say, for twice now to show these movies, which would be
they still get the super, you know, indie ones, art ones, but to be able to survive, I think it is good if they get, you know, Knives Out and such. So this is it's bumming me out.
It's a paradox too, because Knives Out is now out on Blu-ray. I went to Walmart, I bought it on Blu-ray, and I watched it last night.
Yeah.
So because I enjoyed it. But
it's great.
It's a fun film, but it just
if Apple has that much freedom, I wish indie cinemas had.
How much was the bookshelf going to quote unquote rob from Cineplex showing Knives Out 4 months after it came out and a week before it came out on Blu-ray?
It's crazy. It would probably be like in the hundreds, not even the thousands, you know? So rude. But as for the Apple thing, I guess it's rude. I think I'm just gonna have some fun with it. I'll be able to use it to see if like, is that, nope, that's not the bad person. It'll be fun.
Interestingly,
I don't support what you're doing, Apple, but I will use it for fun things.
It's now encoded.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Ana de Armas has an Android phone in Knives Out.
Okay.
And she's the protagonist. So, I mean, could they deke a little? Because technically, not to spoil
so
Knives Out.
Good characters don't have to use an Apple. It's just if there's an Apple involved. Okay.
If they're using an Apple iPhone, they're safe.
Yep.
So there you
but go. I like that, though, for the main character that they didn't – they had them still using an Android because that didn't give it away, right?
No, but she's also using, like, a very battered up Android phone.
It's maybe Apple's show, like a class sort of set.
Well, that's it, and Apple's like, we don't – like, nobody who uses Apple walks around with a broken screen, although that's far from the truth, as we know.
Yep.
We're going to take a quick break and then come back with our review of Portrait of a Lady on Fire. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Sourire. C'est comme si j'avais l'impression de le faire et qu'il disparaissait. La colère finit toujours par gagner. Chez vous, c'est certain. Je ne voulais pas vous blesser.
Vous ne m'avez pas blessée.
Si, je le vois. Quand vous êtes ému, vous faites comme ça avec votre main.
Vraiment?
Et quand vous êtes embarrassé, vous mordez vos lèvres. Et quand vous êtes agacé, vous ne sciez pas.
Vous savez tout.
Pardonnez-moi, je n'aimerais pas être à votre place.
Mais nous sommes à la même place. Exactement à la même place.
And that was a clip from A Portrait of a Lady on Fire. It's a new film from Celine Sciamma, and it stars Neonine Merlant, Adele Hanel, Leona Bajrami, and Valeria Golino.
Mm-hmm. As the Countess.
As the Countess.
Yeah.
No name. This is a remarkably male-free movie.
Yeah, I was okay with that.
No, I was okay with it, too. I'm no complaints with
yeah,
me.
Yeah, no, there was only, like, a singular word from a couple in the beginning when they're brought over in the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And,
the rowboat,
And the one guy taking her painting away.
Yeah.
I think it was also supposed to show, because they talk about it a lot, right, how back in the late 1700s, even if you weren't around the guys, it was unfortunately a male-dominant world, right? Like, it still is nowadays, but back then, like, fully male control, and especially in what this film tries to show in art, which is, I think, really gross, and I think that's really silly for them to do in the late 1700s. You know, they wanted good art, then it was the wrong decision. So I think it was actually necessary and a really good choice to have just females in it.
Yeah, it's almost jarring. I read somebody say, like, when she comes down the one morning and there's the guy who's come to take her back to the boat sitting there at the kitchen table, because there is that opening where even going back to that, because there's the scene, she's being taken by rowboat to this island, and the box with her canvases in them go overboard.
And they don't even help,
And she's the one who has to go jump into in. The drink and get her canvases.
Yep.
And
the film as a whole did a real beautiful job showing what people had to deal with back then when it comes to, sexism, homophobia, You know, just gender, sexuality, all those really important things that especially females had to deal with in, and when it comes to homosexuality, a scary way almost, you know, and especially the Enlightenment days, a lack of true understanding.
And class too.
And class. Oh, class galore. In particular, there's the one really good scene. An abortion is needed, and they go out to the Romas and to get that help. And that was a really beautiful look upon that.
Yeah.
That's something we don't even really hear much about, you know?
Yeah. No,
there's not really any history courses here in U of G that deal exceptionally with Romas and what we know as the G word.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it did a beautiful, beautiful job of that. And I also think getting a glimpse into what abortion was like that back then was real.
And how hard it is. I mean, yeah. It's also like kind of startling that there...
Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, they deal with real things, but they don't deal with the real things that are dark and in-depth because they want to show... You know, how beautiful the Enlightenment and the Victorian age and such were. Whereas this, it shows the realism and how it does correlate with some unfortunate sexism and homophobia that
it's just fascinating that, you know, Sophia, who's the maid who has to get the abortion, I mean, presumably she was impregnated by a man, but
you
never see any man around.
It's not part of it.
When they go to that scene, when they go down to the beach for this... It seems like some sort of celebration of like the female community there, and you know it seems like this is an island of women. It's Themyscira or something, but there must be a man somewhere around, or at least one man. And
but again, it's back then. She was a maid, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter who the guy was. He probably, even if she was pregnant, he wouldn't view it as his kid, you know? There was no marriage. She wasn't, you know, of a high enough class or whatever.
And it's interesting.
Although we don't know. He could be, like, a farm boy or something, too. We were not never shown, but...
It doesn't go into tremendous detail about that, which I was fine with. The thing that struck me, too, was that even though the Countess, who is a woman, and there's a scene where she's talking to Marianne, who's the painter, about, you know, how long she has, it's been since she's, like, laughed and told a joke.
Yeah.
And you know, well, and Marianne says, you know, it takes two to laugh or like something to this effect. And the Countess said, well, it takes two to, like, someone to hear the joke, too.
It's true. Well, she's a higher class one, right? It shows how as well reserved you need to be.
And, I mean, then part of that is patriarchy, too. And it's interesting that even though it is sort of like... It's an old lady's house. I don't know if they said what happened to her husband.
No, I think just he passed away or something.
He's gone and something. But, you know, he's not in the picture in any event. But even though it is this house of women, once the Countess goes, you see the elimination of the classist lines. And you see the three women, even though they're basically of three different classes, Sophia the maid, Marianne the painter, and
they don't have to...
and Holis the... basically the lady of the house.
They don't have someone almost an authoritative individual of the tropes back then, you know, gender and whatever, class. They have a great time and it's it's phenomenal.
And it's like those lines just sort of disappear as soon as you don't have somebody putting them on you.
Yep.
And it's a bit idyllic, I suppose, but it's very life affirming in a way. I left this movie feeling very life affirming, even though there's a bittersweet ending.
Yes, yeah. Bittersweet. I felt a lot of emotions. When it comes to the bittersweet ending, I was actually very okay with it. I did not feel as bitterly sweet to me as I think it would some others, because I've seen La La Land, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have it's like a similar kind of ending. They have no reasoning, and it's just silly, and I hate it. And this, even though it has similar qualities to that, because it were under it set. And just because of the plot, you know, the flow, all that jazz, it was remarkable.
Well, it's an interesting companion to...
A sad ending equivalent to La La Land, but necessary and more truthful, and something that unfortunately needed to happen.
It's very truthful, and like it ends with her at the concert, Holis, or Marianne's looking across the way at Holis, looking at concert, and you can't really see because of the distance, it's implied that Marianne can't really see what's happening on with Holise listening to this concert, this piece mm-hmm. of music that they played together. Now it's reminding Holise of like the week, the basically they were in love,
the
and
greatest week of their lives.
Yeah, and you can see like the emotion play on. Let me get the actress's name because I do want to give her full credit. Adele Hanel. You can see sort of like the whole range of emotion play on her face.
Because the face...
And she's not even like looking at the camera. She's looking offside at where the music is. Mm-hmm. And you can see her breathe heavy. And you can see the tears form. But at the same time, mm-hmm. you can see sort of like hints of anger. It's like, no, I really love this other girl.
Her jaws, her eyes. You know, she
and then
throws
she gets
out
happy.
A lot of...
And, you know, she has happy memories about it as well. It's mm-hmm.
well,
it's so beautiful.
Needed. Yeah, it's one of the greatest films I've seen in a while. It really is. For you, maybe it was Parasite. But for me, my favorite 2020. And I would say better than any I saw in 2019.
It's very, very good. Mm-hmm. I don't know where I would put it. It's like, I don't. You know, always it's always the last thing you saw, right?
But mm-hmm. I like Richard Linklater. I like ones that have such a minimal plot, right? And this is an art film. That's what it was like. And I really liked that. It gets you more in depth into like a singular instance of emotions and something like that. I think that's why I like it.
It's
really beautiful shots too of such a real world that maybe it will make us look upon our house, our nature in a more optimistic way, a more imaginative way.
Well, it definitely rearranges the chairs in a certain way because, of mm-hmm. course, it's Celine Sciamma is a female director. I'm pretty sure she's queer as well.
Oh, who we were just talking about, they dated for like 3 years.
Oh, did they? Okay. I wasn't 100% sure. I was going by interviews I'd read with her.
Her and Adele dated for like,
okay.
like 4 years or something. And they broke up just a couple days before making this film.
Okay, well, that adds some mm-hmm. interesting colors to this.
Yeah, no, the director of this, Celine, is also like every single French Me Too equivalent. She's there, yeah.
Yeah, so. And then the director of photography is also a woman.
Yep.
Claire Matheau.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I was reading some interviews with Sciamma about, you know, how this is basically trying to recontextualize the female gaze. Or the, I guess, subvert the male gaze because it's
yep.
it's a female gaze because it's two women looking at each other. It's a female director. It's a female director of photography, and it's there's a very different vibe to this. It's of course it's sexy because they're beautiful mm-hmm. women, and you buy wholly into their love and their passion. But there's something about it that feels different than if this was something – this was more of a – if this was male-directed.
Well, if it was male-directed, you know.
You know, it doesn't feel like, – I don't want to say icky because that's not the right word, but it just feels different. It feels warmer in a sense. It feels more open in a sense.
Yeah, it really did.
And it's
– I think that's because also if you know there's a male director, you're going to – even if you try to block it, picture them behind the camera, right? And like the whole film being about, you know, females loving each other.
Right. It feels very – it feels very more natural than that. It doesn't feel staged. I mean, of course, there's staging and blocking because that's how filmmaking works. Mm-hmm. But there's something about it that feels very, very more natural. And Sciamma talked about how this was also a movie about consent as well and making consent sexy. And you definitely feel that too.
Yeah, you do.
And I think it was an interview she did where she talked about like, you can use consent to feel, or you can use consent to make the romance or to remystify the romance. So that's what I'm, the phrase I'm thinking of. And that there's something very much to that. The way the love scenes are handled, where it's very much like, is it okay if we do this? And it's there's something to this because I, you know, Robin Doolittle was here last fall and she was talking about in her book, her new book, which is about rape culture and cancel culture mm-hmm. and all that. And it's like we are teaching kids, you know, about consent and kids younger than you even. You know, when they get here to the U of G, they go through all that orientation week stuff like what is consent? How do you know? And it's all very mechanical, very sort of technical.
Yeah, and this, I guess, it shows consent in a way that isn't, well, not in your face isn't the right word, but it's not.
It's not technical.
Yeah, it's not as technical as sometimes they teach you, but it's also a very, very in-depth look upon consent, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But like I said, almost wordless sort of consent, right?
There's a lot of silence in this movie,
mm-hmm.
Which...
Well, it's supposed to show their love, right? And their love had a lot of... There was a lot of talking, but there was a lot of not talking. Their minds were somewhere else.
There's a lot of not talking, but I mean, just also like the sound design, it really does make you feel like their isolation.
Yeah, well, it's silent. There's not much of a score, if any, right?
No, and that's another great thing is when they're down on the beach with the Roma, and they do this song.
It's a really catchy one.
Well, what I found is like it was like shaking the walls.
Oh, yeah, but we saw a bookshelf. That might be the reason, right?
Well, it could be the reason.
I do love bookshelf, but...
but it, you know, and it... And
I found...
Yeah.
I found that... That's, I think, one of the only negatives from the film for me.
Mm.
I loved that part. I loved the song. But it was, like, studio-produced.
Mm.
So it, for me, took away a bit of the realism.
Mm.
But I talked with my friend after. Their theory is that was done on purpose because... Back then, late 1700s, there wasn't Apple Music and such, right? So even if it was just a live performance like that, it would have sounded to them the equivalent of like a really high-produced studio music to us. But that's a real dipped excuse for the one aspect that I didn't like. So I'm going to say I wish it had just been more actually what they were playing as opposed to, you know, music overlaid with it.
I actually found it more jarring because of how little sound there was, how little music there was.
Oh, okay.
It sort of grabs you that way and it sort of like makes you feel the emotion of it. Because, I mean, this was also the turning point where we see at the beginning, it's Marianne teaching an art class and one of mm-hmm. her students points to the portrait of the literal portrait of the lady on fire.
Yep.
And that gets you the segue of how that portrait came to be. And, like, that's the moment where all of this is caked in the batter.
Yeah. I guess the climax of this film almost.
It's,
you know?
Well, it's almost. It's after they've – I can't remember if it's after they've already made love or if it's like –
It's before,
I think. It's before. Because,
even be, like, the night before.
Right. Because, as I said, that's the moment it's, like, baked in the batter where it's, like, this is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's right after, too, a really beautiful oh, what's the dude? Othello and Eurydice?
Right.
Eurydice's?
Orpheus and Eurydice's.
Eurydice's, yeah. Oh, my goodness. I'm in history, too. That was just embarrassing. But I thought that part was really nice, a really good, like, poetic look at what they were dealing with. And I look upon the painting of it, too, that I never really thought about why he was looking back upon her, right?
Well, I mean, it
but that's the point.
It comes dangerously close to one of those moments in a film sometimes where they make like the subtext explicitly text.
Yeah.
But it works in a way because it's both setting up sort of where things go, but it also sets up this idea that this isn't tragedy per se. It's unfortunate, you know, that two people who love each other can't spend their lives together, but on the other hand, they did have this experience.
Yeah,
and this is kind of a spiritual cousin to Call Me by Your Name, or at least how it
I've
feels
been thinking
for me,
about that too.
Where it's like, the two characters in that, the Timothy Chalamet and Armie Hammer character, they don't get to build a life together. And of course, that ends very similarly with just Timothy Chalamet looking into the fire, you know, going over the relationship in his head. But at the same time, they did have that time together.
And the Call Me By Your Name thing, right? That's been going on in Italy for like that. what is it? Pierre Petalini? What was his name? Yeah, 100 Ways to Sodom. That's his jam, right? So that was kind of – that wasn't really too new, you know? Whereas I'm glad that the lesbian community everybody got this. It was a nominal film. But it was glad to get one made by and a focus upon lesbians as opposed to, you know, a film about homosexuality is one thing.
Right.
But, you know, Call Me By Your Name and such is still male dominant. So I just, I really thought this was
it's
a perfect
also,
mixture of that.
I mean, you could also make an argument about female gaze in that movie, even though it wasn't directed by a woman.
Yeah.
There's, you know, I think there's something to that, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah, a really wonderful movie.
Yeah, like I said, one of the greatest I've seen in a bit.
Yeah, yep. It's wonderfully, wonderfully made. The cinematography is awesome.
Oh, that's, yeah. Oh, there was a real good aspect of the rule of thirds, especially by the campfire. Not the campfire, the fire in their the painting room.
Right.
The campfire, it was more just quick glimpses of everybody around the fire and such. Not a rule of thirds thing. But yeah, the fireplace had a lot of really great shots. And one of my favorites was when they went to the beach and when they went into that cave. Mm-hmm. There's a really beautiful layering of the cliffs together. And it just looked really gorgeous. You know, just a regular cliff, but portrayed in a really beautiful way. And they cross together, and it's like under there where they themselves cross together. And yeah, I just thought that was just the one that kind of stood out to me.
Yeah.
But like you said, all around, the cinematography was beautiful.
Come for the romance, stay for the technical brilliance.
Yeah. It was like it was great.
Before we get,
it was like a blockbuster art film, I'd say.
That's a good comparison, but we'll leave that as the last word. Check it out at the bookshelf if you can. That's it for this week's show, and we hope you like it. You can listen to it again on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it from the Guelph Politicast channel on Friday or at Podbean, and you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media at Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Peter, where can people find you on the internet?
As per usual, Mr. Tarak on YouTube and Twitter, Bike Goofs, Episode 1, Declan. Check it out, y'all.
If you haven't already.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll be back on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics with Open Sources Guelph and Scotty Hertz there. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, and you can check out my political site at guelphpolitico.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.